are listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Hello, everybody. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector. Welcome to News Dissector Radio here on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. We've got a great show for you, and we're going to tell you more. But first, we're going to get you in the mood with this new song called Occupy This by Polarity One.
Bankers, corporations throw the country into the gutter like dice. Whatever comes up, they win. Politicians are paid off to keep the game running. There's just no way you're going to be competitive in a rigged game. Some of the best people we have will never get a shot.
Something's happening in America. Polarity One, his new Occupy This collage, very powerful. You heard it here first last week. We're going to play it a little bit. It's a great collage of the energy, the passion of the Occupy movement. We're going to have an update for you at the half hour on what's been happening in Occupy D.C. And later today on Occupy the Courts here in New York, a demonstration where a judge has actually forbidden people from protesting in front of a courthouse. So much for freedom of speech, so much of to our Bill of Rights. This is a growing issue, and it will be a continuing issue. It's the politics of the streets, not the suites. It's not the Republican debate, but it's people who want a new republic, the debating, in essence, by going to the streets and the Occupy movement. Catherine will give us a little report and update a little bit later, along with Lee Camp. But first, we're very honored today to have with us an amazing journalist, someone I have a great deal of respect for, Sebastian Walker, who works for Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera, the network to watch, which is on, 92, Channel 92 here in New York City on the Time Warner network, and it's getting on the air in more places in the country. It's already on the air all over the world. Sebastian came to my attention with his documentaries, his powerful reporting from Haiti, where he was almost alone and really analyzing what was happening there, showing us the pain of the Haitian people. Now he's just come back from the Horn of Africa. And he's going to tell us a little bit about covering Somalia, covering real wars and conflict there. And he's going to discuss all this with us. But first, welcome, Sebastian. Just one thought, one question. Today, the New York Times is reporting that there's been actual convictions of Haitian policemen in connection with that riot that took place in the prisons around the time of the earthquake. And nobody expected that anybody would go to jail, much less there be convictions of police. And yet it's happened. What do you think it means? So what was the background to it as you remember it?
Well, to be honest, this hasn't, as far as we saw, been a huge issue within Haiti. This is something that we were certainly aware of. The story was a big story at the time. It was a great piece of investigative reporting by the New York Times. And I think it's good that there have been convictions in that case. I think the most significant thing about this is that this case was held up by U.S. congressmen in this country as a reason why U.S. aid money shouldn't be given over to the Haitian government. So it was that was very controversial in Haiti, and a lot of money was withheld purely on the basis of this case. Money that was meant to be used to reform Haiti's judicial infrastructure was held back because of accusations that the judicial infrastructure right now is flawed and faulty. And a lot of Haitians didn't understand why, if there was such a great deal of money that was destined to be used to improve things, why that wouldn't be used because of something that clearly showed that there were flaws in the system. So I think that's to me, the most significant aspect
of
this.
Well, Mr. Expert here, myself, is completely uninformed about this. Thank you so much for filling in the context. That's really what Al Jazeera does so brilliantly and offers background ground on issues that we don't really get in our media. And here's a, you know, here's the back story, if you will, which is really the front story, which is not in the media mostly, about why, you know, these things, you know, happen the way they do. And, you know, in your reporting, we're going to be joined briefly, I think, a call from Michelle Martin, who's a filmmaker who's been doing a film on what happened to all the money that was sent to Haiti. And I'd like you to weigh in on that when she calls in. But first, bring us up to speed in terms of your work with Al Jazeera. You were in Haiti for a long time after most of the American media left, and you stayed, and you really documented what was going on there, which was, you know, I would say a modern horror story, you know, of people, in a sense, becoming part of a prison, you know, in these camps of, you know, where rape and crime was very common, where policing was not, where people were suffering, people who had already suffered in the earthquake were suffering again. And you documented it for us very vividly, and very painfully in a way, because it was not a story that everybody wanted to hear. People wanted to think that all the money sent, everything, you know, is like an Alka-Seltzer tablet. You put it in water, poof, you know, everything is new again and solved. And you were showing us, no, hey, that's not what's happening here.
Well, yeah, I mean, we actually spent a year and a half with a full-time bureau in Haiti. I was the correspondent on the ground. So it's actually pretty rare that you have that kind of opportunity to follow a story in that depth as a journalist. It's really something that Al Jazeera does best. It does go for those kind of underreported stories and really put attention on that. So I was there for a year and a half. We covered all sorts of aspects of the reconstruction process. Our job was essentially to kind of monitor and document how things were progressing. The film that you were speaking about is a film that we made at the six-month mark, showing that there were very big problems. Unfortunately, 2 years on, there was just the anniversary on January the 12th of this year. That was 2 years since the quake occurred. The situation on the ground is still, you know, all of those same problems exist.
And you know, I was actually, you know, I'm a, just by way of background, you know, I'm an American journalist. Clearly, I worked at ABC News for 8 years. I worked at part of the startup team at CNN. I worked at CNBC. I was sort of in the mainstream media for a while until I finally defected from it. Now I write for Al Jazeera's website on a regular basis and other outlets. And I happen to be on RT, Russia Today, right after the earthquake. Happened when the American forces were coming into Haiti and taking over the airport. And if you recall, their first task was what they called force protection, protecting themselves. Okay, nobody went with aid into Port-au-Prince, which was down the road, so to speak. They were kind of getting themselves in shape. At the same time, when experts on disasters were saying, if you don't intervene in the first 3 days after a disaster, you're not going to save lives. And yet here was the American, quote, experts taking over the airport, preventing a plane from Medicine Without Frontiers from actually landing at the airport. So this was a disaster compounded by the United States and maybe by some of the NGOs who were there sort of competing with each other for attention and funding and not really helping the people. It's a bizarre situation.
Yeah, I think, I mean, to us, what really colored the whole immediate response to the earthquake was the prioritization of security. And I think that was the fundamental problem, which meant that there were all of these delays, there was, you know, bottlenecks of aid distribution. People were scared. Every time the sun set for those days after the earthquake, those working on immediate response, the search and rescue teams, most of those teams actually went home because there was such a security concern in Haiti. There is a fear that Haitians are in some way dangerous, that if you go to Haiti, it's a very dangerous place. I think that fear is pretty universal amongst international news organizations, that there is this perception that Haiti is a very violent
and
dangerous
American
country.
Paranoia, you know, and unfortunately it translates into the media also. There was some really important coverage, Sanjay Gupta and you know, Anderson and others who made a commitment there, actors like Sean Penn who were there and made a really deep commitment. Dr. Paul Farmer and his partners in health that did so much for the people there. But, you know, the story of the response to this crisis to me is a crime in itself, okay? And that the money that so many Americans gave, one out of every seven Americans gave money to try to help the people of Haiti. A tremendous outpouring of solidarity. And for that money not to reach the people for whom it was intended and whom we were told it was going to be sent to me is criminal. It's disgraceful. It's something I'm ashamed of as an American, but yet it's not an issue in most of our media. Mm-hmm. Now, since this disaster in Haiti, you've moved on, as many journalists do, to other disasters, and you're just coming back from the Horn of Africa. Can you tell us a little bit about what you were reporting on there? I'm going to have a little clip from one of your programs in a second, but tell us what's going on there.
Sure. We actually went to do two films, one about the drought situation in the region and the other one about the famine itself in Somalia. So for the Somalia film in particular, it was a very disturbing picture. I mean, I've never been to any kind of famine environment like that, and it is the most kind of overwhelming catastrophe you could imagine. There are, the similarities with what was going on in Haiti in the days after the earthquake were there. The way the aid is distributed and the kind of the problems
that's
of the aid
system.
That's
a human quake there, not an earthquake.
Yeah, but famine also is. I think in both cases it is. It is international policies that have contributed to exacerbating the situation on the ground. Famines are man-made, and they're not a natural disaster. Famines are something that you can see coming a long time in advance, and people were warning about the famine about to hit Somalia 18 months ago. And even after those warnings came out, the actual appeals for aid went unsupported, and those laws that international governments have in place to try to curb the influence of al-Shabaab meant that you could not...
Al-Shabaab being...
The organization that actually controls most of Somalia. Al-Shabaab is a terror-listed organization by the U.S. government. It's an Islamist...
Terror-listed, but maybe not really terrorist, but no doubt there's a war going on there in which people are... dying, in a political conflict. You know, people who are poor tend to fight with different weapons than people who have planes, and tanks. So I'm not there to pass judgment on this movement, but it certainly is one of the part of the whole kind of Al-Qaeda, whatever, conspiracy that keeps so many policymakers in Washington, up every night. And, there seems to be an American intervention there.
Well, yeah, I think that is part of the famine problem, because one of the reasons why it's been so difficult to distribute aid in parts of Somalia that are controlled by al-Shabaab is that there are sanctions in place which make it legally difficult for NGOs and humanitarian organizations to get aid into those areas. The U.S. actually relaxed those sanctions in August of this year because of the complaints that they were receiving from UN agencies, WFP, and all of the kind of big donor agencies and organizations. They actually said, okay, we're going to relax some of these rules because we can see that it's making it more difficult to respond to this very urgent crisis. But by that point, there were already nearly 30,000 children under the age of five that had died from starvation. So I think there's a lot of anger amongst those organizations and amongst those humanitarians on the ground at why it took so long for people to start taking action.
Well, these sanctions, which are supposedly part of our get tough approach to the world, to stop terrorism, etc., often have unintended or intended consequences of actually hurting the people, not the governments we're trying to sanction. And here we have a story in this country, Minnesota, where there are many refugees from the Horn of Africa trying to send money back to their
right.
families. They can't do it because of these so-called sanctions that the United States has put in place, and the guise of doing good, it's actually doing bad, as far as I can tell, and really upsetting. Mm. So, this is something that needs to be documented. Let's listen, if we could, to a little bit of your new film about the Horn of Africa, and we'll ask you some more questions about it. You know, this is really important work, and we don't hear much about it here, but the effect on the people there is dramatic and continuing. All we hear about Somalia are the so-called pirates, because that's a sexy subject, with Americans going back to the, to the shores of Tripoli and the U.S. Marine Corps, anthem, which was a fight against the Barbary pirates back in the 1800s, and now we're replaying that without any understanding of what it's really all about. Let's hear it.
It was here that the world first witnessed the scale of a catastrophe taking place beyond its consciousness. As starving Somalis streamed across the border with Kenya, the numbers had swollen dramatically well before famine was declared in July. By September, there were nearly 450,000 people pushing its boundaries. But Dadaab refugee camp has been here for two decades. Testament to a collective failure to fix a broken country. Ibrahim Arden's one-year-old son died this morning. It's the second child he's had to bury in Dadaab.
Another one of his sons. When did the other one die?
5 days ago.
5 days ago? In another grave? Can he show us? You can see the number of fresh graves that are here. They say there are 25 people buried in this area. Most of them have died in the last 2 weeks. And they're saying that many people in this part of the camp have fallen ill to measles.
Well, that's just a little taste, a little excerpt from the film that Sebastian Walker has completed, and it's going to be screened in New York. And listeners to this program are being invited to this screening tonight at 7 p.m. to come see this film, powerful film, Al Jazeera film that you may not get to see if you're not a regular Al Jazeera viewer. Sebastian, where is it happening?
Yeah, thanks, Danny. Yeah, we're actually showing the Somalia film. We did two films. One was on mainly Kenya and the areas that have been affected by drought. But the one that was most distressing for us as a production team was definitely Somalia. That's the epicenter of this crisis. And we're showing a film tonight at 7 p.m. at 96 Lafayette Street. So, yeah, if anyone's listening that's interested
Lafayette
in Somalia.
In New Yorkies. Lafayette,
so hurry up.
Not Lafayette.
Sorry,
but that's okay.
That's my accent.
That's okay. I'm joking with you. So come tonight. And what's the name of the place, the hall?
I think it's the Santos... A party house. It's a venue.
Santos Party House.
Yeah.
And come see it if you can, because it's an issue that you really need to know about. We're not getting informed about it here. We're more debating whether or not Newt Gingrich what he said to his former wife than really talking about what's happening to millions of people in the world who are suffering. Our media is totally out of whack in terms of what priorities are. In fact, Newsweek apparently has an item of recommendations, and say Newsweek is saying watch Al Jazeera because Al Jazeera is offering news and information that Americans could be offering but aren't. And that's why we're calling attention to it on this program. That's why I write about it on News Dissector, my column, newsdissector.com, my daily blog. Try to highlight these issues that are not being covered here. And this is an important one. Now you've got the invitation to come to see the film tonight. It's free, and you'll meet Sebastian Walker and some of the folks from Al Jazeera. So I think it'll be very exciting. We have on the line with us Michelle Martin, I believe, who is a filmmaker herself, who was going to be on the program last week and was going to call us when she got through customs in the Haitian airport in Port-au-Prince, and instead went into the chaos of that airport and wasn't able to get the call out. Hi, good. How are you? Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you for having me on, and actually I'm going to have to say my last name's actually Mitchell.
Mitchell. I'm sorry, my mistake. Yeah, my mistake.
That's okay, Joe.
It's an M, MMM. Okay.
Exactly.
Okay, could be. It's not. I didn't say Marilyn Monroe. I could have said that with two
well,
M's.
That would have been nice.
Okay, go ahead. So tell me a little bit. You've done this film about where the money went in Haiti. What did you find?
Well, I got interested in this topic because what we've seen happen in Haiti in terms of a disaster response by NGOs, non-governmental organizations, is a situation we've seen with just about every natural disaster or war zone scenario in the past few years. And we saw problems with the response with Hurricane Katrina here in the U.S., for example. We saw it with the Asian tsunami. And Haiti was supposed to be different by the own admission of the humanitarian community. They said, this is going to be humanitarian aid 2.0. We're all going to work together and try to help this be the best relief effort ever. And that's not what happened at all.
And so your film documents some of this. When can people see it? Where is it?
It's currently airing on PBS stations nationwide, so check with your local PBS listings, or you can come to our website at filmat11.com, and you can find the listings there. But what's important, what was important to me about Haiti was that it was such an outpouring of support from people in this country. You have one out of two households in the U.S. actually donating $1.4 billion. And what happened to that? That's an enormous amount of goodwill and money that it was a very interesting process to track. And we went to Haiti twice. We went 10 months after the quake, and then we went back again at the 20-month mark.
Sebastian, you were there also. Sebastian Walker is with us, Michelle. You spoke to people about the money coming in and how it was being spent. I mean, for example, a lot of NGO organizations were buying, you know, kind of fancy cars to move around in and what have you. What do you think went wrong here?
Well, that's the system as it works, and that's been the system for years before the earthquake. I think one of the things that you can say is that the earthquake at least is highlighting and exposing some of these very fundamental problems that mean that Haiti is stuck in this cycle of poverty and dependence on foreign aid. And I think in terms of where the money is going, I remember being there at the one-year mark and reading a story, I think it was the Associated Press doing an investigation about the U.S. Donations, the funds that you were talking about coming from families in America, that 98 cents out of every dollar that U.S. Nationals were giving to Haiti was flowing back to the U.S. because the way that it's spent is it's given to American organizations, contractors, all of those groups that essentially come in and do something in Haiti, use that money and spend the money, and then actually the kind of long-term good of where those donations are used isn't Haiti. It actually goes back to the USA.
I remember a story, you know, where some wannabe contractor came down there with trucks and whatnot to try to clear up the rubble, and he was sort of using TV news as an advertisement for himself, and he wasn't able to get a contract. And, oh, I could handle this in a minute, you know, sort of thing. So, you know, a lot of issues played out, the rivalries among the aid organizations, the insensitivity, the incompetence of the military as a agency, as a lead agency in providing aid, the shunting off of the UN and the people from the UN who actually knew what they were doing. Okay, the UN actually has, I found out, air traffic controllers that work for the UN that could bring in these planes, and the US military just dismissed them and pushed them off to the side. So the people who had the most knowledge to help basically were being pushed out of the picture, you know, for organizational priorities, political priorities. The president, you know, Michelle Obama was doing these ads for the American Red Cross. I haven't seen an audit on what the American Red Cross actually did in Haiti, how much money actually reached people there. But these are issues that are really important, because the next time it's going to happen, again, it even happened here in New York. If you remember with 9/11, there was a lot of questions about where the money that so many people gave actually went, who benefited from it, and how come it didn't reach the people who needed it the most. And in some instances, because of politics, it took 10 years for the people who were the first responders, were cleaning up the 9/11 Ground Zero site, who came down with all kinds of diseases and many died, to get any recognition and help from our government. So incompetence seems to be the rule. Bureaucracy seems to be the rule. And that's why journalism is so important, to expose all this. Am I preaching, Sebastian? I'm sorry if I am.
I
offending
totally agree
your journalistic
that. No,
sensibility.
I mean, one of the interesting things to me as well is the money that hasn't even arrived. I think it's only 30% of the pledged donations from the U.S. has actually arrived in Haiti or been dispersed. And I think it's great that, Michelle, we've seen your film. We think it's excellent. And I think it's great that so many people are starting to talk about this now. And I was at a very interesting panel in Washington, D.C. with members of the Haitian diaspora, and I think some people from PBS too, talking about these issues. And there is now a lot of attention focused on this, and the very severe crisis that's going on in Haiti, the cholera situation, The presence of 12,000 UN peacekeepers, the third largest UN peacekeeping mission in the world in a country where there is no conflict. I think those issues are now starting to be highlighted more and more. So
and also that the Nepalese peacekeepers actually are accused of bringing the cholera to Haiti. There have been matches made between cholera in Nepal and cholera in Haiti, and a pattern here of just a lack of attention paid, supervision to all of this, and great difficulties, and very little attention paid to the people of Haiti themselves who are struggling. You know, instead of using some of this money to create jobs, to get these people to work, cleaning up their own country and empowering them, the money went to foreign contractors, American contractors, and the like, and did not reach the people. Story that can't be told enough. It's not being told enough, in fact. And, you know, thank goodness for Al Jazeera's persistence on this subject. What about, you know, Michelle, sorry, we're moving very quickly here, but just tell us one more time how to reach your website, Film at 11. Is that what it is, Film at 11?
Yes, it's filmat11.com. And I do want to add here that one of the big issue that needs to be dissected is this lack of transparency and accountability. Because, again, I mean, Haiti, you have Representative Yvette Clark actually says in a documentary that that NGOs have supplanted government in Haiti, and you do see this. There's a serious lack of accountability and reckoning in countries where the government may not be strong, such as Haiti. You didn't see this, for example, happen in Japan, right, or in Chile. Chile, they actually kicked out NGOs who didn't live up to the job they said they were going to do. And in the case of how NGOs operate, they don't have to tell you exactly where they spent the money. Many line items in those tax returns, in those 990s, are voluntary. And the fact is, Congress could have oversight hearings, and donors could demand accountability. And those two things really have to occur if the people in Haiti are going to be helped, and also to prevent this from being the response in future disasters.
Oh, my goodness. We have so many things to talk about. You're so articulate, Michelle. Thank you so much, even if I bungled or mungled, to use an M word, your name. But thank you for coming on and telling us about it. Please go see this film online. Find out when it's on your PBS station. And follow this work and these issues because they're so important. And also tonight, as we mentioned to you, we have an invitation to come to see this new film by Sebastian Walker, who's here with us at the Santos Party House on Lafayette Street. Do we have the address on that?
It's 96.
96 Lafayette Street, or if you prefer, since we do have two people from across the pond here, Lafayette Street, who are here with us. Thank you so much, Sebastian, for coming in. I'm sorry.
Thanks for having us.
This is so quick, but we'll do it again if and when we can and really get into the details, because I really have so many questions about your work, how you managed to do it. We did speak to one of the people who worked with you, and it's a producer on your project here. I forget her name, but she
Andrea?
Yeah, Andrea.
Andrea Schmidt. Yeah,
she was great. You know, so we're trying to follow this here on News Dissector Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.com, PRN.FM. When we come back, we're going to get an update on the Occupy movements, the latest action and demonstrations, and then we're going to meet with Jim Keady, who's back from Indonesia, who's been a fighter for the that issue and for the rights of workers there, and a fighter against poverty worldwide. And he's going to be joining us here. So please stay with us. You're listening to Dissector Radio.
Look at the movement, man!
It's so fantastic when you pay with plastic. That's from my film, In Debt We Trust. It's about the debt crisis, and few countries in the world have experienced that crisis as deeply as Indonesia. And we're going to tell you more about that in a second. But first, we wanted a little update on what's happening with Occupy, the Occupy movement. Catherine is here, and Lee Camp is joining us. Lee, you were in D.C. as part of Occupy D.C. What was that about?
It was about people from the Occupy movements around the country coming to D.C. to really stand in the face of our elected officials and say that we got a lot of issues we need to deal with. And we were down at Congress and then Supreme Court and then White House, so we did all three branches of government.
So was that a good education for the folks who came and for the Congress, of those members of Congress that you were able to interact with?
I know they went into the offices to see if they could meet with any of them. I don't know whether any of them actually met with the occupiers, but I think that the energy was tremendous, and it was pretty amazing. Around 7 p.m., everybody marched from the Capitol to the steps of the Supreme Court, the videos on YouTube and stuff, and it was really incredible. The energy, it was really heartwarming for me to see that the energy for Occupy has not died down and is still there, and people are still angry and ready to stand up to make changes in this country.
You know, I did an interview this morning. Lee Camp, we should tell you, is a brilliant satirist and comic and entertainer, and I did an interview this morning, a pre-interview with CBC. I'm going to be on CBC Monday morning at around 7:30 in the morning, and to talk about Stephen Colbert's race, you know. And their whole tone was like really dismissive, you know. He's just a comedian, you know. He's just an entertainer. I said, by the way, do you remember the name Ronald Reagan? What do you think he was? Or Arnold Schwarzenegger? What do you think he was? Why so dismissive? Because their notion of politics is all about party politics, about that boring debate in South Carolina last night, and not about the politics of the streets, the politics of people trying to demand real change. And so our whole media frame is off kilter.
Yeah, and I think it's almost a scary thing. It's a good thing for my career, but it's a scary thing that people are now getting their truth from comedians, because it seems to be that the politicians aren't willing to speak the truth, so they're getting it from other outlets. And The Daily Show and Colbert and some of the stuff I do is really where people seem to feel like they can get a genuine response to these issues. And, you know, Colbert at the press corps dinner was one of the most amazing moments of truth we've ever seen, you know. So it really is. People are getting their
information out. Just on this point, and I think it's important, you know, I have a column I write for Al Jazeera on their website, and I did one on Stephen Colbert this past week, and one of the things I quoted were newspapers in other countries, including Angela King, the Telegraph in Britain, and Liberation in France, and the Spiegel in Germany, and their whole approach to American politics was to compare it to a circus, a really bad circus, you know, and compare the politicians, you know, to entertainers. They don't take it seriously at all. I think it's the laughing stock of the world. So, some laughs.
You say entertainers, I say puppets.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Lee Camp, thanks for joining us. Catherine, you're here. What's happening tonight with this Occupy the Courts action in New York?
Well, at 5 p.m., they're going to be gathering at Liberty Plaza, you know, also known as Zuccotti Park. They're going to march to Foley Square, 6-7 rally across from Thurgood Marshall U.S. Courthouse at 40 Center Street. And there's scheduled speakers, Reverend Billy, Russell Simmons, Chris Hedges. There's information to get involved and corporate personhood, NewYorkCity@gmail.com. And also, they do not have a permit for this rally. I just want to let everyone know. Constitutional law judge finds no First Amendment violation in denying a permit for Occupy the Courts rally. So it's definitely going to go on anyway, but it might be just a little hotter than...
So there you go. You know, suppression of free speech seems to be part of what this whole movement has brought out, the lack of tolerance for activists. And this is a story, I think, that our next guest, Jim Cady, knows well, because, you know, it's one thing to protest in front of an American court, but if you're a group of Indonesian workers who are taking on the system there, what happens?
Sure. Well, first, Dan, I want to thank you for having me on today. I want to give a little background on how I got involved in this. Back in the late 90s, I was a soccer coach here in New York City at St. John's University. I was also studying for a graduate degree in theology. And while I was coaching with the men's soccer team, the university started to negotiate a multi-million dollar contract with Nike. And part of that deal required me as a coach to wear and promote their products. Same time this deal was getting negotiated, I was doing a graduate degree in theology, as I said. I was writing a paper about Nike's labor practices. And what I found was if you wanted to pick a company that violated everything that our Catholic university stood for, Nike was the perfect case study. And at the same, as this was going